Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, his book, Rock in the Kremlin, My Incredible True Story of Gangsters, Oligarchs, and Pop Stars in Putin's Russia, David Junk joins me on the program to discuss it. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is your story, but it's told with Fred Bronson. And I'm curious, because in Fred's relation in the introduction, he talks about you kind of pitching it to him to participate. And I want to know about like kind of what led into the decision to enlist Fred's help on this book.
Well, Fred was interviewing me for an article he was writing for Billboard magazine about Russia being blocked from participating in the Eurovision Song Contest. And I was, someone who had taken a couple of artists to the Eurovision Song Contest from Russia way back when I was an executive for Universal Music. And with Russia being blocked, he wanted to understand how important that was for the prestige of the country and just have some context for it. And I, at the time, had been thinking about writing my story about my years in Russia working in the music industry when it was really, the wild, wild east over there, frankly, when I got there in the 90s and then the rise of Putin in the 2000s. So I had seen a lot and I wanted to write about this. And Fred took my idea after we did the interview. I told him my idea about the book. He took it to his publisher, and his publisher wanted the book right away. So Fred came back to me with the good news, and I asked Fred to help me write it because this is my first book, and I wanted it to be, you know, entertaining and not just a history of the music industry, but real interesting, thrilling stories, because that's really what it was for my life in Russia during those years.
So that making it interesting aspect of it, like, is that trying to get him to put it in a writerly way, like, or are you kind of telling it to him as if you were storytelling and then he's kind of transcribing? Like, what's that kind of?
More like that, yes. Like, more like the latter. I had a series of almost 40 interviews with him over several months, each interview more than an hour long. And he essentially was transcribing my stories. So those are my words, but Fred's... Fred's grammatical structure, I guess, and corrections and edits, but these are stories straight from my mouth. Yes.
So is he giving you, like, are you giving him questions to then ask you, or like in terms of like, how does he kind of draw this out of you, let's say?
Well, you know, we start with a book proposal. That's what I initially submitted to the publisher, was the idea of a 40 chapter book about my life in Russia. And in that proposal has a lot of information that Fred gleaned for questions. But most importantly, the chapters were laid out chronologically. So that made it easy for him to formulate questions to me like he would interviewing an American Idol contestant or someone like that. That's how he does his writing, and that's how he did it with me, and so the stories came out based on his questions and my sort of laying out chronologically how it all started and then how it all ended.
Now, were you like a diary keeper, or had you kept some sort of journal or record of your time in Russia, or like is it just kind of what you were able to remember when he drew it out of you?
Unfortunately, the latter. It was what I was able to remember. I should have kept a diary. The what was fortunate for me is being in show business. A lot of what I did was videotaped. A good chunk of it was even interviews on TV and things like that. So I was able to put together from a lot of the old archive footage some interesting things for the book, especially when I was fighting piracy. I was in the Russian media quite a bit back then, and so I was able to use some of those old news interviews to remember some of the stories that had happened to me. But you know, unfortunately, I did not keep a diary, but I did keep in close contact with the staff that worked with me all those years, the Russian staff, the marketing team, the sales team, and of course, I asked them for to help me fill in the blanks where I was missing something or another. But generally speaking, those are stories from memory and not from a diary.
Did you struggle with that at all? Like, were there blank spaces for you thinking back?
Well, you know what I struggle with is I'm remembering now stories that I forgot to put in the book. That's what's the biggest frustration because and at some point you can't put everything in there. You have to it has to be a cohesive piece of work that is, like I said, entertaining for the reader. The goal Fred and I set out with was to make each chapter something you could read in between subway stops, really just getting through it, the book pretty quickly, and teasing the next chapter so that you're eager to keep flipping the pages. And I think that's what we achieved. We really wanted this to be interesting for folks, entertaining as well as informative. We knew we had something very informative. My perspective on Russia is unique. I lived there 15 years as an American. I saw a lot of things that, pundits on TV can only talk about. I experienced firsthand. So we knew we had something really interesting, but we wanted to make it entertaining as well too, because after all, this is a story about the music business, show business.
It doesn't start that way, though. You talk about David Block being kind of the reason you end up in Russia.
You mean, excuse me?
So you're because it was through farming initially, right? That you
Yes.
or John Block,
Yes.
not David Block. Sorry.
Oh, John Block. Yes. I yes. John, former Secretary of Agriculture John Block. Yes, who worked for Ronald Reagan, who lifted the grain embargo on the Russians in the early 80s when Reagan became president. And who inspired me to, because he's a farmer. I was a farm boy, Midwesterners. And he was looking at Russia in a unique way that no one was looking at them like. Remember, they were the bad guys for many, many years. And of course, the invasion of Afghanistan was a major stain on the Soviet Union. And then when they shot down that passenger jet over the Sea of Japan, I actually one of my classmates in college was on that jet. She was studying in China. She was on her way to study in China, and she was killed, as well as 250 other passengers by this by the Russians. By a MiG jet, shot it down. So Russia was the evil empire. Reagan had labeled it the evil empire, but John Block found a way to build a bridge, a business bridge, starting with business, and that inspired me. And that's what I wanted to do when the Berlin Wall came down. I wanted to build bridges between these former superpower enemies.
And so the business that you choose is show business, is through the music business. You do make the argument that, like, ultimately what you were hoping was that the culture would, like, plant the seeds that would bear some fruit of, harmonious relationships between the two countries.
Right. And I must correct you. I didn't choose it. I got lucky, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I really stumbled into a job in the music industry. I just really got lucky. There's no other way to explain it. I just was there in Moscow, and I answered a help wanted ad from in the Moscow Times, and it was Polygram, the world's largest record company, was looking for an accountant. a financial controller, and I had just gotten a business degree in San Francisco. So I was just really lucky to have stumbled into that to that job. But what it did was it opened up so many opportunities for me to build a bridge between Russia and America that no one else was even thinking about. I mean, the most people were involved in, the finance industry or oil or gas or, natural resource extraction, a lot of banking, a lot of Americans were helping and working with Russians in all kinds of industries, but music, no one was thinking about that. And so I was the only one, the only American in the music industry over there. And that allowed me to have a little bit of credibility, to be honest. I was looked upon to help come up with the best path forward to modernize the Russian music industry so it could, be a healthy and contributing part of the economy and not controlled by the Russian mafia, as it was when I arrived in the 90s. It was 90% of it was controlled by organized crime, producing counterfeit CDs. So that was the biggest fight, I had in front of me. But I do believe that bringing Western music to Russia in the 90s and early 2000s did have an impact, a very positive impact. Those were really good years between America and Russia. We had very strong relations then, and it, of course, all fell apart with the rise of Putin and authoritarianism. But I do think we made a difference by bringing so much Western culture into the country, and I think eventually that will pay off.
Yeah, you make that argument towards the end of the book when you talk about Ukraine and what's been going on. But you also, I think, kind of point towards it in earlier chapters, not just in fighting piracy and looking to bring industry and not just criminal enterprise to the music industry in Russia, but also through kind of like showing Russia to the rest of the world, because it's not just bringing those like international artists or American artists that were on Universal to Russia. It was finding Russian artists to then share with the world and show the like commonality amongst the music.
Yes, that was probably the most exciting part of my job was signing, finding, and then signing Russian artists to the label, and then trying to promote them internationally. I wanted to be a real record executive. I always knew the Clive Davises or the Jimmy Iovines or the real superstar record executives of the music industry were famous because they were able to find and develop stars and make them world famous. And I wanted to do that from Russia for Universal. And I sought out to do that by looking for Russians who could sing in English, because it was very clear that, if you really want to sell your music around the world, you have to sing in English. And there's no better example than Sweden. I always use that example as look what ABBA did, look what everyone from Roxette, Ace of Base, so many bands from there, and they sing in English, and that's a great example for other countries to follow. And so I looked for artists that could compete. And this is, remember, this is 1999, 2000, 2001. The biggest artists in the world are Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, NSYNC, Backstreet Boys. That's what the scene was like for pop music at that point. And so I needed to find a Russian artist who could compete with Britney, right? And I needed to find a boy band that could compete with NSYNC. That's really what was driving my search for music. And fortunately, I was able to find and discover three artists that were able to sell records around the world. Tattoo was the first biggest international breakthrough for a Russian artist ever. They sold gold or platinum in 27 countries and over 5 million albums of their English debut. And that to this day, they're still the biggest selling Russian music act in history. So that was a real thrill to be able to bring that music to the world.
Yeah, I've heard that. I haven't seen it yet, but Anora, which is apparently likely to be nominated for Best Picture, features a needle drop from Tattoo at the end that's pretty significant.
Interesting. I didn't know that. Wow, that's interesting. Wow.
And it's some sort of Russian oligarch's son who's the like central character in the movie. So it's apparently
that makes sense then.
tied in. So there, it's still having an impact, you know, like a quarter century later, basically at this point. In terms of like finding those talents, like were you like traversing the country or were people coming to you to the offices? Like how did that go about?
All of the above, honestly. I did visit many cities in Russia, the biggest ones, from Vladivostok to Novosibirsk to Sochi. Of course, St. Petersburg many times. There's a great rock scene in St. Petersburg dating back to the Soviet Union. So I spent a lot of time there. But Moscow is the entertainment capital of the country. It's everything. It's finance. It's politics, obviously the Kremlin is there, but it's also the center of culture and music. And so people would come from wherever, all over to Moscow and bring us demo tapes and try to get meetings with my A&R staff and that kind of thing. Just like a record label ought to work. You know, that's what we started there. We were the first to do it this way. And then the other labels came in, Sony, BMG, EMI, and then the Russian labels too. And so everyone started to emulate this model that we set up, which was just essentially what Universal did in every country, right? It was just repeating what a typical record label should do. And so that's what we did. And we really were able to create a modern music industry by developing those Western business practices like that. And it lasts till today.
You eventually leave Universal, you move back to the States, but then you're drawn back to Russia through Gibson Guitars. And I'm curious, like the decision that led you to leave Russia initially, what overrode that to go back?
Well, when I left Russia in at the end of 2005, the country, it was deep in the middle of a terrorism crisis, one terrorist attack after another. And I write in the book that, you know, all those years, 15 years over there, and I was never really intimidated by the gangsters or the oligarchs or the corrupt police or Kremlin officials. I was driven to leave Russia the first time because of the terrorism and Russia's security services' complete inability to protect its people, to rescue hostages. I just witnessed too many hostage situations gone wrong, gone terribly wrong in the case of the theater in Moscow, Dubrovka, where even Americans died in that theater hostage situation when they pumped fentanyl gas into the theater and didn't have an antidote to rescue the hostages. But it killed all the terrorists, but it also killed a lot of the innocent hostages too. And then the next one that really scarred me was on the first day of school in September. A terrorist took a small school in Beslan hostage. Over 900 people were held hostage, and the Russians again terribly managed this rescue situation, brought in tanks, brought in attack helicopters, and it went wrong as well too, and 333 people died, including almost 180 children. So that got to me. It was enough is enough. This country cannot protect its people or has the will to do so. So I moved my family out, and I followed when I finished my contract. And I went back in 2013, about 7 years later. There was no longer a terrorism crisis, and the Russians at the Kremlin were able to subdue the Caucasus, essentially bribing, paying off, you know, leaders to keep things under control and keep the peace in Chechnya, especially. So it was, you know, really a period of relative calm, and that made me feel like, okay, I can go back.
So you go back, but then things reach a certain point where you're seeing some of the overreach, let's say, of the Russian government and the, like, you know, territorial ambitions, and it hits a point where it's enough for you again.
Right. Well, you know, the Kremlin always needs an enemy. And when I was in Russia in the early 2000s, the enemy was Chechnya, right? Chechens, right? But after that, when in 2013, the Kremlin needed a new enemy. And this time it was Ukrainians that they became the enemy. And that's how, you know, the Kremlin maintains its power, by keeping the people focused on an external threat or problem. That's how they get away with their massive corruption and stealing. So it worked. The Kremlin basically put together a propaganda campaign that got that convinced enough Russians that it's right to claim back Crimea, which at one point Russians believed was part of the Russian Empire. And the propaganda also persuaded enough Russians that it's the Kremlin's duty to protect Russian-speaking people living in Ukraine who are allegedly being discriminated against. So that was nonsense, all complete utter nonsense. And I'm there with Gibson guitars. I had just opened the first Gibson guitar showroom in Russia. It was a resounding success. Who doesn't love Gibson guitars? You know, all the rock stars in Russia were really eager to work with us. And I had the best job in the world. I was Santa Claus, essentially. I was giving rock stars to I was giving guitars to rock stars. Sorry, that's what, and anytime someone was going to be on TV, that was my job to put a Gibson guitar in their hands, because that was advertising for the brand. And so it was a great thing to be bringing another iconic American company to Russia, and really the future looked amazing. But this drumbeat of propaganda eventually led to, well, you know, after the Sochi Olympics, because the Winter Olympics were in Russia for 2014. As soon as that Olympic flame was extinguished, Russian troops were in Crimea and they had invaded. And so there you go. That was the end of that. No more peace, no more Olympic message of international peace. And that was the moment I knew, okay, I'm probably out of here. You know, this is going to be intolerable very soon. And it just became more and more intolerable. And I was out of Russia a year after that.
You mentioned earlier about, you know, now you've thought of some things that you didn't recall when you were writing this book. I'm curious, because, you know, having been a music executive, the notion of like a B-sides, you know, like the stuff that was left on the cutting room floor being released, does that exist in publishing?
You know, I don't think so, unless they let me write a bonus chapter or something like that. But I certainly am keeping, you know, the side notes of what I left on the floor, on the cutting room floor, And I'm ready to assemble it, because I am remembering some funny stories too. I always want to make sure I tell the fun stories in the book, but I think I got the best ones. The best stories that I have are in there, and they're the ones that mean the most to me, for people to understand, you know, what I was doing there in Russia those 15 years, what America was doing during that time period. It's been very important for me to defend America and people who claim that, you know, we were sore winners after the Cold War, and we didn't help Russia, and we cornered Russia with NATO expansion, and that's the reason all this is happening. And I just believe that's nonsense. I believe it's utter nonsense. And my career is proof that we did help Russia after the Cold War. We helped them in many ways, financially, but also American know-how and business practices. And we helped build all kinds of different industries, including the music industry. So it's been very important for me to push back on folks who think we didn't do enough after the end of the Cold War. I really believe we tried. This war started because Putin is, you know, Don Corleone, and he runs Russia like a mafia state, and he wanted Ukrainian territory. Resources. That's why this war started, not because of NATO expansion.
And to reiterate, as you do in the book, you weren't part of the CIA. This wasn't some sort of, you know,
no
op.
No.
To,
I don't think they could have pulled this off, because this was too cool. You know, I don't think they would have been able to be as creative as we were in the music industry. And frankly, it's all based on supply and demand too. Russian kids demanded hip hop from the West Coast. Russian kids wanted Snoop Dogg and Jay-Z and Dr. Dre and Eminem, who was a breakthrough. The Marshall Mathers LP was a major breakthrough for hip hop and rap in Russia and throughout Eastern Europe. So I saw how much Russian kids devoured, loved this music, and they loved it so much they created their own hip hop industry, their own hip hop music business, and those are the bravest artists in Russia today are the rap and hip hop artists.
I was going to say, that's one of the things you point to in the end chapters about Ukraine, that some of the fiercest voices against Russian annexation are coming from the hip hop community.
Yeah, I'm very proud of a few of the artists. One of them I worked with while I was with Gibson. Noise MC is an artist who had to leave Russia because he was singing and speaking out against the war. And he and some of his other colleagues in the hip hop community that are in exile do a lot to raise money for refugees and raise awareness about the fact that there are millions and millions of Russians who do oppose this war. And of course, there are even more millions that are silent about it. But these stars, these artists are genuine heroes, I believe, and history will look very kindly on them.
Well, you can read more about them and about David's adventures in Russia, in Rock in the Kremlin, out through Roman and Littlefield. David, thanks very much for taking some time to join me on the program, and congrats on the release of the book.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. Fantastic questions. I really enjoyed it.